Accession number 26562, Mr. Ken Taylor, Real 20. Mm. Now, where are we now then? We're between 1957 and 59, you were at HMS Mercury.
I got married when I was there, and I used to pride myself on, I knew everything that was happening in my division. They couldn't get away with anything, couldn't do anything. And I got the biggest shock of my life when I was asked by the officer in charge of New Inches, one of Nature's gentlemen, to come into his office. When I went in there, all the class leaders from all the new entry classes was there, and they got a canteen of cutlery, and they'd all collected amongst the new entry a canteen of cutlery, and I was up for once in my life I was absolutely speechless. And when I did manage to get some words out, I said, I'm going to have to look into my organisation. I thought I knew everything that was happening in my division, and this something's been going on secretly here, and the chief knew nothing about it. Anyway, I left Mercury in...
looks like 59.
59, and joined HMS Trafalgar in Portsmouth. She was leader of the 7th Destroyer Squadron. After work up at Portland...
Now, what you were joining her as what?
As a chief of the squadron. Chief of my own radio department, also chief of the squadron, because she's entitled chief of the squadron. I had an acting petty officer as well on board, which I always felt sorry for, because he didn't need me really. He could have done my job, so I had to make sure he was fully occupied. And in fact, I managed to keep him fully enthused and fully active, because he ended up as a lieutenant, and he lives out at Breed, not far away, and I see him quite a bit.
So your role was not only your own ship, but the rest of the
well, to a degree. I mean, we had the squadron signal officer.
Which squadron was it?
The 7th Destroyer Squadron. And I mean, I had a squadron signal officer, but I mean, he's entitled to have a chief, shall we say. I mean, he's more responsible for the squadron. Although I could farm off a few jobs, to the other ships, being the chief. A lot of work to do in getting the ship up to scratch in Portsmouth. And then we went to Portland for work up. Shook things up a bit in Portland. They're supposed to shake us up, and I shook things up a bit there, because I'm that sort of bloke. First off, they used to, apart from the normal sea shake-ups and trials and communications, they did landing communications, and they had completely the wrong frequencies. So I got the frequencies changed while I was there. The chief in charge of the shore station there, I was very friendly with him. And just to let him know that I wasn't sort of being sort of critical or anything else like that, every time we came into harbour, I used to send some of my lads up to Elvermount, because he was very busy, and so they used to work in the harbour up there. And I got frequencies changed. Also sorted things out with submarine communications, because one day I went into my office and we were exercising with a submarine, and you always have a submarine safety net. We have the ship is on this net for submarine safety, and I said to the operator, because this is part of the job of working up, getting your people into your way of working, and I said to my operator, is she up or down? And he didn't know. And I said, those chaps on that submarine are relying on you for their safety, and you don't even know whether they're dived or up. So I said, as soon as we get in the harbour, I shall arrange for you to go to sea on that submarine, and you can pray to God that there's a better bloke at this end than you are. And that was appreciated. Well, then I said to my signal officer, the Royal Navy always has trouble in communications with the Royal Air Force. And we're always after exercises, there's always repercussions and what's that. I said, I would appreciate it if you could arrange for a couple of our lads to go to the RAF, go on the base and get their communications set up there, be taken out in an aircraft when we're doing the trials with these long-range aircraft at sea, and sort things out. I had a leading hand and two telegraphists gave up their weekend to go. They got to the RAF station, and I'm afraid to say the RAF are bigger snobs than I thought they were, because when they found they weren't officers, they didn't do anything for them. And the lads didn't see the base communication set up. They put them in the back of an aircraft. They didn't have airphones. They didn't know what was going on, anything else. So when we had the mock-up afterwards, the admiral in charge of the at Portland, and there's all the RAF and the Army and the Navy, everybody's there, and all of all the ships, and he started sounding off. He said, once again, he said, communication from the Navy and the RAF is falling foul, da 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 da. And I started to get up because I'm that sort of bloke, and my signal said, see, and I was going to get up and say, you know, we did our bit, you know, where was the RAF? And anyway, I thought, I don't want to let him down in case he gets a rocket, you see. And I grabbed the squadron leader and I told him, I said, my officer wouldn't allow me to talk to the ambulance. I said, I'm telling you. And I told him what happened. He said, I'll look into it. From there, we went out to the Med. Very good crew. You know, all the normal things, exercising with the French. About to do Cyprus patrol, you know, sort of the ships on Cyprus patrol. Visited Greece, Italy, North Africa, yeah, a very enjoyable commission. Came back, paid off in 61. From there, obviously have a leave, and then went to signal school. I was a cryptographic instructor for the last 2 years of my service.
Now, what was that like? How did you enjoy being an instructor?
I was a qualified instructor, but it was the first time I've officially been an instructor. But the Navy always comes back at you. From when I first went to sea, I preferred the technical side and the radio operating side. So although I had to do cryptography, when I was in charge, I always got someone to take charge of cryptography. And I dodged cryptography for nearly 23 years. And the last job in the Navy, they made me an instructor in cryptography. So I had to get the books out quick and get on top of it. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, actually. In fact, the officer in charge of the cryptographic section, he ended up being a lifelong pal of mine until he died. We used to visit regularly. He retired just before me. He was an ex-lower decker. He was a signalman.
And you finished in
63, June 63.
Now, what were you going to do after all this, Nate? I mean, we'd just like to get you back into civilian life, you know, because you'd left civilian life 20-odd years before.
Well, the sad thing is that they give you a booklet. Now, Lord Louis Mountbatten changed the title from a Petty Officer to Begovis and a Chief Petty Officer to Begovis to Radio Supervisor, Chief Radio Supervisor. He said this would make it easier for jobs in Civvy Street. I hated the change. A concierge being called a supervisor makes things better in Civvy Street because you're less than a foreman. You know, they gave you a booklet which, so you could give to an employer to say, this is what he's qualified in, this is all the jobs he does. It had no relevance at all to my career. It was based on the chaps at the time I left, not chaps at the time I joined and through the time. Chaps when I left, so when I joined, you had to be responsible for the maintenance of your own equipment. You had to be responsible for designing and putting up your own aerials and all that sort of thing. Later on in the Navy, they had radio mechanics, because things got technical, very technical.
So how did you get a job?
So that I couldn't settle. I was the unhappiest man. I couldn't settle in Street. A chappie asked me to go into partnership with him as an insurance broker. I said, I know nothing about it. He said, I will train you and guarantee you £20 a week. And that was my wage as a chief, £20 a week. And I thought, well, that's good, because a chief's wages was good then. I'd only been with him a short while and found out he was the biggest rogue going, so I had to quickly learn about business, and I got rid of him, got him out of the way.
In what way did you have trouble acclimatising to civilian lifestyle? I mean, what was it?
I found, being perfectly blunt, I found in Civvy Street politics, backstabbing, snivelling. You know, and the other firms, I maintain that, especially when you've got the big firms, there's 60% of management as involved in politics, backstabbing the bloke above them, trying to get behind them.
Internal politics.
Internal politics, terrible. A lot of snidiness. don't, I want your word, I'm going to tell you something, don't tell it your mate. And I've had this when I was a supervisor and another supervisor, and it already meant, I'm going to give you a Christmas bonus, but he's not going to get one. And you already promised he would. I could not, I mean, the naval blokes are not angels, but they're open and honest. And I couldn't sell, Joan knows. I worked as an insurance broker, I worked as an estate agent, I worked as two types of salesman.
And what did you eventually settle?
I worked as a milkman. Now, all these things, when I was a milkman, I went on a course with the governor to, and they found out I knew more about instructing the boat that was instructing us, so they made me training officer. Still meant I was a milkman, but I added training officer. I did courses. I qualified in work study. I qualified in production planning. I would never do a job without going to night school and learning. And I was never happy till the day I retired.
So you never really settled in a proper job at all?
No, the last job I had was Kraft Foods. I had 10 years with them, and it was the most boring job I had. I was in production planning, but they didn't really know how to use production planners to their full potential. But at my age, I had to take it and carry on because there you are, you know, you've got to live in.
Now, do you still keep in touch with your old comrades?
Yeah, well, in the Navy. Oh, yeah, mainly at reunions. I mean, I wish I could see some of my lads more, because most I see is ones at the Chiefs reunion and some of my ship's reunions, but don't see, I mean, a lot of them may have died, you don't know, but I mean, I do see some, but not as many as I'd like to see.
And are they important to you, the Naval Association, the various ones you
mentioned? Yeah. One of my, give you a very good example, one of my new entries, I went to a reunion and there was a Chief Petty Officer with a big black beard. And he came up to me and he said, you don't recognise me, do you, Chief? I said, yes, I do, Mackay. And he'd been one of my new entries. And there he was, a chief. And he just turned around to me, joking. He said, you were a bastard. And I said, yeah, but I made a chief out of you. He said, fair comment. Do you know what? He looks at me every reunion. We always have a drink together. His son's a member now. His own son's a member of the... because we took on associate members as petty officers. So his son's a member. He introduced me to his son. We all meet. But... you know,
so you don't regret any of your naval career?
Oh, no. I always say everybody in life makes good decisions and bad decisions. I was 15 years old when I made the decision to go in the Navy, and that's the most sensible decision I ever made in my life. And yet I hear these people today saying, oh, when he does something wrong, he's only a boy, he's 18, he's only a boy. And I think, rubbish.
Thank you very much.